On September 16, 2010, the Korea Economic Institute and the CSIS Korea Chair co-hosted an event to mark the release of a new public opinion survey of American attitudes toward the Republic of Korea, conducted by the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. The survey, which is the first of its kind, covers a wide range of topics, including the future of the US-ROK alliance, South Korea's role in Asia, North Korea's nuclear program, and the Korea-US Free Trade Agreement. The panel featured a special report on the survey by Victor Cha, Korea Chair at CSIS. Also included was commentary by Christopher Hill, Dean of the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver, and Marshall Bouton, President of the Chicago Council. The panel was chaired by Jack Pritchard, President of the Korea Economic Institute.
Hello everyone, to the Korea Economic Institute. I'm Jack Pritchard, the President. It is a distinct pleasure for us to partner with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs and for CSIS, and to have Ambassador Chris Hill with us for this panel. What we're going to do is I'm going to introduce the panel members briefly. Marshall's going to go first, talk about the overall survey for which this panel is part of it. Then Victor, who is a principal author of the report on the U.S. attitudes towards the Korean Peninsula, is going to be following that. He's got a presentation, so the other three of us are going to come down here and sit so you can actually see rather than just look at our face and the shadow back behind our face. And then we're going to ask Ambassador Hill to give his some comments and presentation, a little bit of a presentation on his reaction to the survey and kind of reach back to his time at both as Ambassador and Assistant Secretary. See how these surveys of today stack up to what he has witnessed himself. Well, let me, by way of introduction, first of all, as I say, welcome to KEI. I need to give credit to Ambassador Tom Hubbard for the display that you see on the wall that went up yesterday and last evening. This is a new partnership between the Korea Society in New York, for which when they have finished with a wonderful gallery displays that they have that goes through their New York offices, they've been very kind to ship them to us so we can put them up here. So those of you that have an opportunity to follow Korea can benefit for the good work that the Korea Society has done in organizing this. So as you have a chance, preferably not during the panel, get up and go take a look at the at these wonderful photographs, and you can probably read the wall description from your seat there. So let me get started. And again, thank you very much for coming. We appreciate it. It's been a busy day today. As I said, I'm going to start with a just brief introduction. Marshall Bouton is the president of the Chicago Council. He's been there now for 9 years, almost exactly. Prior to that, he spent 20 years at the Asia Society in New York and had a career in the State Department for a while as well. Victor Cha, to my immediate right. You know, I had to go back up to the title because in your own bio, you don't say anything about CSIS. You just said Georgetown, so I don't know. It's a CSIS.
That's the wrong bio.
Ah.
The wrong bio.
Oh, yeah, this is not you on the picture either. Victor, as you know, is a senior advisor at CSIS and is the Korea chair. And it's under the auspices that we've joined forces today. He is also, as you know, Director of Asian Studies and the D.S. Song Chair in Government in Asia at Georgetown University. And a lot of you know him in the media from his stint as the Asia Director at the NSC from 2004 to 2007. I almost don't need to give an introduction to Ambassador Hill. He's had a fascinating career, which is, you know, just kind of remarkable in terms of where he's been, who he has dealt with. But as you know, he's most recently retired from the State Department, having spent the last year plus as our ambassador in Iraq, having, as you know him most in this group, having been the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs. And as the head of the Six-Party Talks delegation. And prior to that, he was the U.S. ambassador to Korea and Macedonia, Poland, a number of things. So we're very privileged to have Chris with us today. So with that, let me ask Marshall if you'll kick us off, please.
Thank you, Jack. I first want to thank you and the KEI for hosting this. My connections with KEI go back about 30 years from my earliest days at the Asian Society, and we partnered with KEI from there, and I've continued that partnership to the extent I've been able to from Chicago over the ensuing 9 years, and it's always been a great privilege. It's a unique organization, really important for all of us, and I want to thank as well Ambassador Hill, Chris Hill, for practically getting off the plane from Baghdad and coming to join us in talking about Korea. I can't imagine someone more qualified to comment on the findings of our study. Our study is the result of a team effort. Several of my team colleagues are here. Rachel Bronson, our Vice President for Programs and Studies. Tom Wright, our Executive Director for Studies. Steve Call, you all know here in Washington for his fine work at the Program of International Policy Attitudes, has been a member of the Council's Public Opinion Survey team now for almost a decade. Greg Hollick, now at Washington and Lee, has also been involved in this and two other previous studies. So Ben Page has been involved since the beginning of the study in 1974, unfortunately could not be with us this afternoon. We were very fortunate as well to get Victor's help in not only in the analysis and interpretation of the results, but in the design of the questions that we asked about Korea. As you all might be aware, this is part of a larger, much larger study that the Council has conducted as part of its ongoing series of public opinion studies, but we, with the very generous support of the Korea Foundation, we were able to greatly amplify the coverage of Korea in the questionnaire in order to try to answer a number of very important policy questions. The larger study was funded very generously by the MacArthur Foundation and the McCormick Foundation, and we're grateful to them as well. What I would like to do is to give you a little sense of the arc of the larger story that the public opinion study provides of American public attitudes on a wide range of international issues and U.S. foreign policy. It's the most comprehensive study we have done since 2002, when we were in that moment endeavoring to understand the American public mind just a year after 9/11, less than a year after 9/11. Here we decided to return to that more encyclopedic format precisely because, again, there have been, as we all know, some if not tectonic shifts, at least some tremendous developments, the financial crisis and recession, the U.S. amplified U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, the drawdown in Iraq, the new administration in Washington, endeavoring to chart some new courses for the United States. So we want to understand how the American public is thinking about all of these things. And we have a special interest going back some time, particularly in U.S. relations with Asia. And so it was very comfortable for us to focus again on Korea. So what are the sort of headlines of the larger study? And there are copies of it out here for those of you who haven't seen it. It's also available on the Chicago Council's website. The broadest explication of the findings are that Americans are feeling constrained by both conditions at home and challenges abroad in ways that are causing them not to head for the isolationist exits, but to want to see our nation adopt foreign policies and national security policies that are more selective, that they regard as necessary adaptations to the realities around us, the realities at home and the realities abroad. At home, of course, the greatest concern is the economy. And what we are seeing is Some would term it pessimism. Some would term it discouragement or great worry, great anxiety about our economic future. It's not only the current conditions, but the way that the events of the last 2 years have caused Americans to be doubtful about their economic future. And as you all know, this is part of the essence of the American dream, and it's a very profound shift. 60% of Americans think that the next generation of Americans, those who are now children, will be economically worse off than the current generation. And that's really saying something given the nature of our society and our history. That, of course, translates into great concern about resources. And to that has now been added the concern, whether justified or not, in purely economic terms, about federal spending, the size of the budget deficit. We see in these results, though we did not intend it entirely to be a focus, the great concern about federal spending and the budget deficit. Looking outside the United States, what Americans see is a much more complex, changing world in which our influence and power are at least in relative terms diminished. We ask a question whether you think the United States is playing a more important role, more powerful role in the world today than it was 10 years ago, or less powerful, or no change. And for the first time in almost 20 years, Americans say, there's a sharp drop in the number of Americans who say that we are playing a more important role. So these are of course, relative shifts, but it's a very marked relative shift. They also see a narrowing of the differences in influence between the United States and other nations, and in particular, China. And 10 years from now, they expect China to be as influential as the United States on the world scene. They accept, broadly, a less dominant, if you will, less hegemonic U.S. role. If anything, they have been concerned, going back many years in the past, according to our survey results, that the United States was playing too much the role of world policeman. How do we interpret that phrase? That we were taking on commitments and responsibilities, involving ourselves in conflicts and problems that weren't necessarily our own business, are certainly not critically important to U.S. vital interests. And in fact, we also have a question, a well-known question that's been asked by other organizations. Do you think that what's more important, fixing problems at home or dealing with challenges abroad? Americans have always put the focus on problems at home, but we have seen an unprecedented number come forth on that subject. 91% of the American public believes that we should give more importance to fixing problems at home. Now, it's kind of hard to imagine 91% of Americans agreeing on almost anything. So that's a pretty startling statistic. Now, that said, Americans are, as I said, are not heading for the isolationist exits, nor are they really asking for a sharp drawback in American international engagement. In fact, in many ways, the most important finding, given what we expected, given what you might expect, given the conditions and concerns that I've described Americans harboring, that there would be some isolationist sentiment or move away from internationalism, that's not in evidence at all in our study. The questions that we and others have always used as standard indicators of whether Americans are turning isolationist, a question that goes back to just after World War II, whether Americans should play an active part in the world or stay out of an active role in the world. The number there is very stable at about 2/3 of Americans who say we should play an active part. So the kind of high level, conceptual level about American international engagement, Americans are still hanging in there. But what we see at the same time, and it's spread throughout across the issues we raise in the survey, is a desire on the part of Americans that our engagement in the world be much more selective. much more shaped to what they believe to be the critical threats and important needs of the United States. There are several principles we describe in the study as undergirding that selective engagement. First and foremost, they want and they're willing to see enormous effort and resources put against the topmost threats to the United States, which they consider to be terrorism, international terrorism that threatens the American homeland, nuclear proliferation, and along with those two, the concerns about both Afghanistan and Pakistan in terms of those countries as locations for against from which terrorist attacks against us might be launched. They're close to the top is also energy concerns, though that issue is a more diffuse one. So against those threats, they're ready and willing to see every instrument of American power used. They're less concerned, they're more reticent, I should say, about conflicts, particularly interstate conflicts, where they would deem the United States has no direct and vital interest. And they want, by and large, for us to stay out of those conflicts. These are majority views. These are not, obviously, consensus views. They also are willing, at the same time, to see the United States involved actively in responding to humanitarian issues, crises around the world, which they clearly deem to be relatively low risk and low cost. But that impulse also springs from their values. So again, Americans are the fundamental value orientations that Americans bring to their international engagement, we don't think is changing, except insofar as there is a desire to refocus on economic strength at home, which they deem to be the most important source of national power overall. So with that, let me stop, Jack, and look forward to hearing from Victor.
Marshall, thank you very much. I think that has given you a taste of the overall survey, and now Victor is going to hone in on the topic for which we're going to continue this panel. I'll put you up there, and we'll go down.
Well, thank you, Jack. It's been a real pleasure working on this project. Let me first say that for some reason you did have the wrong bio, because as you can see here, we're the Korea Chair at CSIS. We were really happy to collaborate on this project with the Chicago Council, with Marshall, and with Tom Wright. In particular, Tom Wright, Director of Studies at the Chicago Council, is actually a former PhD student at Georgetown. So it's good to see our Georgetown alums doing very well. And it's a particular pleasure to share the stage with my former colleague in government and friend Christopher Hill, who I think many of us sort of stayed in intermittent contact with him while he was in the green zone. But it's great to have you back here among us who work on Asia. So welcome back. And it's also a pleasure to see Tom Hubbard as well. As a chairman of the Korea Society, who's been doing a fantastic job with that organization in New York. Let me say that first, I did this analysis of the data with another colleague of mine, Katrin Fraser, or Katrin Katz, who I don't see in the audience here. She actually followed me on the National Security Council as Director of Asian Affairs, and so we teamed up together to work on the analysis for this report, and she deserves a lot of credit for it as well. The basic idea we had going into this was, you know, we had President Obama at the G20 summit emerging from his bilat with Im Myung-bak talking about how Korea was the linchpin of security in Asia. We're all remembering the 60th anniversary of the Korean War. And the relationship between the ROK and Washington right now is incredibly good. It's in many ways at a high point. And I guess one of the questions we wanted to ask was, does this translate, right? Does this sort of translate into general public views of American views of relations with Korea? I think these questions that were written into the Chicago Council survey are the first in quite some time that have asked some of these questions of Americans, especially about just Korea. And I think, as you'll see, the findings, I think some of them are pretty much predictable in the sense that we've seen these findings before when the American public has been polled on issues related to Korea, but some of them are quite astounding. And for me, especially as an academic who's looked at these issues, I think in some of these findings actually undercut the conventional wisdoms that are out there both in the academic world and in the policy world about American views of Korea. So let's go to the first of these, which is a general question. Thank you. A general question about the US-ROK alliance. And the question that was asked here was, if North and South Korea were to unify, should the United States end their alliance with Korea, maintain the alliance with troops, or maintain the alliance without troops? And here the numbers were actually quite surprising. 43% of Americans believe that the United States, after unification, should maintain troops, maintain the alliance and troops in Korea as a potential counterweight to China. And 37% of Americans said that the United States should maintain the alliance after unification with Korea, but without ground troops. So if you put all that together, 80% of Americans that were polled believe that the United States should maintain an alliance relationship in some form with the ROK after unification. I think this runs contrary to a lot of the conventional wisdom that basically sees U.S. interest in Korea as largely limited to the North Korean threat. And then after the North Korean threat is gone, then there really isn't much of a need for this alliance relationship. In fact, a lot of the academic literature that has been written about American views of Korea have said that basically American views of Korea are only focused on the nuclear issue and North Korea. And therefore, once this issue is solved, or if unification were to come, then support for the relationship would dramatically decline. As the survey showed, actually only 14% of Americans polled advocated ending the alliance after unification. The question of how much Americans view China as being the critical factor in terms of generating the continued resiliency of the alliance, we did cross-tabulations of the data that show that generally for those Americans who believe, those Americans who see containment of China as being an important U.S. objective, those were the ones who were much more likely to say keep the alliance with troops. Right? On the other hand, those who did not seek to contain China did not see the need for troops as a part of the alliance relationship. But again, overall, the number, 80%, is a pretty at least in my mind, surprising and astounding number. What does this mean for policy? I think, you know, U.S. Public support for this long-term alliance, may provide some opportunities for the U.S. and Korea to work together in ways to hedge against China's rise. Now, this in no way means that the United States should take these surveys and then decide we're going to design containment strategies for China with the ROK, because as we all know, there is no support in the ROK for something like that, and in fact, there are quite high fears of entrapment, of being caught between the United States and China if there were ever a conflict. But I think short of that, what these polls show is that there are an array of opportunities that the United States and South Korea have in terms of improving their relationship that many Americans would support. Increasing intelligence cooperation would be one sort of tacit way of doing this. Improving trilateral coordination among the United States, Japan, and Korea would obviously be another way of doing this. This is in other parts of the study, this emphasis on working with the allies is still seen as very important by the American public. 57% of Americans believed that it was better for the United States to work with allies in trying to engage China than trying to do a power condominium with China and degrade your alliances. So there's still a lot of focus on that. But again, what I think this first set of findings shows is that the U.S. does not have a particularly one-dimensional view of the alliance as only being about North Korea. And I think many of the efforts, the years of efforts, I mean, efforts that Ambassador Hill, that Ambassador Pritchard, Ambassador Hubbard have undertaken to broaden the alliance in the eyes of Americans may finally be bearing fruit. So good work, man. Good job. The next set of questions was on U.S. military presence in South Korea. And here, essentially, we asked, do you think the United States should or should not have long-term military bases in these countries? Okay. And the countries listed, I don't know if you can see them from back there, South Korea, Germany, Afghanistan, Iraq, Japan, Pakistan, and Turkey. And here, I think, again, the findings are contrary to the conventional wisdom. More Americans thought the United States should maintain a long-term military presence in Korea than in any other country cited in the survey. 62% of Americans favored a long-term military presence in South Korea, which is 10 points higher than Germany, and which is more than 10 points higher for Japan. Moreover, when Americans were asked about current U.S. troop levels in Korea, and these were specified as around 30,000 troops, 50% of Americans said that number seemed right, which is an increase from 2004, where 34% said that number seemed about right. And those who thought the number was too many, right, 30,000, actually declined. So in 2004, 52% of Americans thought the U.S. had too many troops in Korea. Today, only 34% believe the United States has too many troops. And there's similar trends were found in the polling on Japan. So I think what this implies in terms of policy is that these the base realignment efforts that have been taking place in Korea, both in the Bush and the Obama administrations that have been underway since 2004, are well intentioned and they're well supported, and that we may have reached, in the eyes of these Americans, an optimal point in terms of the size of the American presence in Korea. Not too much, not too little. Which is, perhaps a sign that a lot of the work that has been put into the alliance relationship over the past two, three administrations seems to be impacting the way Americans think about long-term presence in Korea. Okay. The third set of questions were on the North Korean nuclear issue. And here, respondents were given three policy options to deal with North Korea. One of them was basically the negotiation option, which was to negotiate an end to North Korea's nuclear programs, even if it means accepting the North Korean regime as it is, and even if it means continuing the division of the peninsula. Okay. The second option was what you could call the regime change option, which is to change the regime even if it results in instability or even if it runs the risk of instability or further proliferation. And then the third option was the, no offense intended to anybody here, but what I call the China option, which is basically to maintain stability on the peninsula even if it means accepting the North Korean regime and its current nuclear capabilities. And of these three options, the plurality of Americans, 50%, chose the negotiation option. A not insubstantial minority chose the other two. So 20% chose regime change, 20% chose China, right, chose the China strategy, but 50% chose negotiations. So I think, again, what I think this shows in terms of the broader scheme of things is that the American public has been, and you don't really, sometimes we lose sense of this here in Washington, D.C., you know, but the American public generally has been supportive of basically 20-plus years of U.S. diplomacy in terms of trying to pursue denuclearization with North Korea. So, you know, anybody out there who's still a fan of six-party talks, you know, there's still hope because the American public still has faith in you. So, that was another finding that we thought was quite interesting, and again confirms a lot of the work that has been done by all of these men up here in the past on the North Korean issue. That they may have not gotten all the support that they wanted in Washington, but they certainly had all the support of the American public. The next set of questions were on the scenario of a North Korean attack on South Korea. And here, you know, I would basically say that the findings are essentially quite similar to findings that have been accumulated over past years when asked the same question. So while the other stuff has undercut the conventional wisdom, this is pretty much what we've seen in the past. And the question was, if North Korea were to attack the South, would you favor or oppose the use of U.S. troops? That was one question. And then the other question, a separate question, was, would you favor U.S. contributing forces together with other countries in a multilateral or U.N. effort? And again, consistent, I think, with the larger findings that Marshall talked about in the Chicago Council, generally Americans are not averse to fulfilling their treaty commitments, but they really do feel much more comfortable with the use of American power as part of a larger collective effort, you know, either backed by the U.N., or in terms of some sort of multinational response, and generally uneasy with the unilateral exercise of military power. So when they were asked the question about you can see the results here, Americans generally prefer seeing the use of the U.S. military as a part of a larger multilateral or U.N. effort. 80% of Americans in the broader poll basically agree with the statement that the United States is playing the role of world police more than it should. So this finding is pretty much consistent with what we've seen in the larger poll and consistent with what we've seen in terms of U.S. responses to these questions in the past. Okay. I'm almost done. The last set of penultimate set of questions were on trade. And here the question was, what was asked was what the percentage of respondents who believe the United States should or should not have a free trade agreement with these countries. And the countries listed here are Japan, India, South Korea, China, and Colombia. Here, support for a free trade agreement with South Korea is tepid. Right? It's at 42%. But as you can see from the survey, this is not specific to Korea, but consistent with an overall expression of U.S. ambivalence at free trade agreements as a whole. Not surprising, given, you know, high rates of unemployment, you know, historically high rates of unemployment here, as well as the perception that free trade agreements mean outsourcing of American jobs. I should point out that this survey was done, if I'm not mistaken, before President Obama made his statement at the G20 in Toronto about how he wanted, how the White House wanted the U.S.-Korea free trade agreement to move forward, pending resolution of the resolving the outstanding issues. What was particularly interesting about this finding was, on the policy side, is that I think, in the battle to convince the American public of the merits of the free trade agreement, what a lot of people have been doing, including the Korean government and private sector and those in Congress who support the agreement, what they have been doing is basically telling everybody about the merits of the agreement, about how many jobs it will create and all this. But what's interesting about this particular finding is that these numbers, 42%, came out even when the respondents were told what the benefits of the free trade agreement were. But what is particularly interesting is the cross-tabulation of the data shows that support for the free trade agreement strongly correlates with American perceptions of whether the country in question is perceived to be a free trader, right? Is perceived to be a fair trader, a fair trade nation. So if you're an American and if you're asked this question and in your own mind you believe that Korea is a fair trade or free trade nation, right? If that's what you believe, then support for the FTA is very high, 61%. But if in American minds they do not believe Korea is a fair trade nation, then support for the FTA drops dramatically to 27%. So on the policy side, you know, if for those who support the free trade agreement, you know, it's much better to make efforts to try, instead of talking about the merits of the free trade agreement, talk about Korea as a free trade country. Talk about Korea's record as a free trade and fair trade nation, about its open sort of, its open financial system and its open legal system. These sorts of things are much more likely to enhance or affect views of American views of the free trade agreement. Okay, and then finally, in spite of all this, we had some what I think pollsters call basic knowledge questions that were put into the survey, the precursor that I should mention about this is that I am told by pollsters that Americans generally do not do well on basic knowledge questions. Okay. So despite all of this good stuff, all of these interesting findings, Americans still remain poorly informed on Korea and on South Korea. For example, only 51% of Americans code South Korea as a liberal democracy, right? Despite the fact that South Korea probably represents, in the history of international relations, one of the most successful peaceful transitions to democracy in the history of the modern nation state, right? 40% of respondents do not code South Korea as a democracy. You know, they were given different categories. So only 51%, only half, understand that Korea is a democracy. 50% of Americans think South Korea is a predominantly Buddhist country, right? 50% of Americans think South Korea is a predominantly Buddhist country, which of course does not reflect the reality. And then on trade, this is something that also matters for the free trade agreement. A large majority, 71% of Americans do not realize that South Korea is one of America's top 10 trading partners, right? It is the seventh largest trading partner, but 71% of Americans don't place it in the top 10. And 25% don't even know it's in the top 20, right? So this, you know, overall, I don't think this is not for policymakers, this is not an everyday problem. The fact the American public is misinformed, I mean, what, 23% think Obama's a Muslim, right? So so it's not really in terms of daily sort of stuff, it's not that important. But I think that this level of misunderstanding about Korea can be a problem when you have times of crisis, right? Because what these last set of findings are essentially saying is that even though there's a lot of support for the relationship today in the long term, there is really this vulnerability. There is a soft underbelly to this alliance relationship in the eyes of Americans in which they don't really know a lot substantively about Korea, despite the fact that it is a country that shares common values and common political institutions with the United States. And the problem is that if you have external shocks, like the beef protests, right, Highway 56, when you have these sorts of external shocks, images, views are very malleable, right? And because there isn't this core understanding of South Korea among Americans and could quickly turn negative. So one of the big, I think, takeaways from this is a lot more effort needs to be put into not campaigning for the FTA, but just generally increasing an understanding of Korea, of its political systems, of its values among Americans. Just to conclude, because I know that most of you are here to welcome back Chris, so just to conclude, let me say that I think what these findings do show, as Marshall and I talked about the other day, is that, you know, the MASH years of American views of Korea are over, right? We're done, right? It's not just about the Korean War and MASH anymore in the eyes of Americans. There are different views. Some of them are very positive, but they're clearly still not fully developed. And again, I think overall, many of these findings undercut what a lot of scholars have written about American views of Korea, in which the focus or the presumption in a lot of that work is that the only thing that matters for Americans is this North Korea issue. And that is clearly not the case from this work. So thank you very much, and we look forward to the comments. Now.
I want to just complete the introduction. I'm so impressed with the totality of Ambassador Hill's public service career that I forgot to actually mention what you have before you, and that he is now the dean of the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. Now, we really didn't forget that. I forgot it because, you know, Chris, I don't know if you saw it, but we've got your logo on your car. So, we, as I said before, we're very pleased that you're here. You've been away from Korea for almost a year and a half, but obviously from the turnout today, people don't think that you have gone very far, and so we're going to give you a chance to come back to the issue of Korea, give your impressions of the study as Victor has laid it out, and then we'll begin a little general conversation.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Jack, and let me say it is a great pleasure to be dealing with things Korean. It's a great pleasure to sort of get reacquainted. Victor, it's true, you and I exchanged emails from time to time. I tried to get you to come to the Green Zone. You never came. But it's great to see you back here. Marshall, as always, good to see you again. And Jack, as a sort of fellow warrior on these six-party talks, it's good to see that there are futures for people who get through the six-party process. Let me just say that as I've seen these data and listening to the presentation that Marshall gave, and also the article that Victor wrote in his presentation, I do take a lot of heart from the data, because I think basically it shows an essential pragmatism among the American people in how to approach some of these issues out there. You know, I was reflecting on the fact that some 50% of the respondents supported the idea of a negotiated approach to the North Korean nuclear issue, and I think it was only some 18 or 19% that talked about regime change. And I kind of reflected on some of the internal discussions we had when I was working on this issue during the Bush administration, and I think the percentage of people, of some of my colleagues, who wanted regime change rather than negotiation was perhaps greater than 18%. But I would also like to point out that I think the American people understood something that some of the so-called elites didn't understand, which is a lot of what we're trying to do with the six-party talks was, yes, of course it was to try to denuclearize North Korea, but it was also to close what had become a kind of gap in perceptions between the United States and the ROK. And that during the time leading up to the movement, at least on the six parties, we were dealing with a South Korea which seemed to be far away from where the U.S. was, and we both of us seem to be going in the wrong direction. I know that during Tom Hubbard's time as ambassador in Seoul, you kind of felt a little of that. Certainly, the policy context from Washington was very different from the policy context in Seoul. So I think what we're trying to do was to make sure that there was not all this discord and daylight between Seoul and Washington. And I like to think that one of the successes of the six parties is we very much closed that gap, and that as the ROK went forward with elections, we did not see that the U.S. ever became an issue in those elections. On the contrary, I think the relationship improved. And I think we got enough momentum, and I think the fact that we have an extremely capable ambassador there now, Kathy Stevens, that the and the ROK has Dr. Han Duck-soo here, that really the relationship is being pursued on a broad basis, whereas the North Korea issue could have driven us apart from each other. I think we prevented that from happening, and that in turn I think has allowed us to reconnect on a number of areas, and I think the relationship is very broad-based, and sure enough I think the American people are seeing that. I think in every good work, though, you see that there's room to be room for improvement, as Victor pointed out toward the end there, and it is very worrisome. The American people don't know enough about what went on in the ROK in terms of democratization. I mean, those of us who, I was there in 1987, we certainly were very aware of the historical developments. Probably for the American people, some of those historical developments in the ROK and in 87 got kind of overtaken by the events in Eastern Europe in 89. And so probably it didn't really give people enough time to reflect on the fact that Korea went from a sort of military-led regime to, I think, one of the, as Victor said, one of the most impressive democracies the world has seen, and a transition that was quite quite breathtaking. So clearly there's more work that needs to be done there. I think it's also heartening to see that the American people have understood what I think many Korean people understand, which is the nature of this alliance is not just an ROK-U.S. alliance against North Korea. It's an ROK-U.S. alliance, which essentially is there because of our shared values. And it's not a question of having an alliance that's designed to be opposed to somebody or some other country. It's an alliance that's designed to really make sure the two countries come closer together. I think all of us who have worked on Korea in recent years have felt the disappointment that we were not able to get the free trade agreement through. But I think all of us, despite that sense of disappointment, also have a sense of resolve that the free trade agreement is something that is good for both of us and ought to get done. And I think the value of some of these data is to show why we're having some trouble on the free trade agreement, why there is a sort of gap in perceptions, and I think that gives us some clues as to how to proceed. And I think there's no institution better poised to do that than KEI. So I think, Jack, not only do you have your work cut out for you, but it's very, very it's very clear that as you succeed, I think we may get closer to this this FTA. So, coming back from Iraq, I didn't quite get off the plane from Iraq today. I've been back for a few weeks now, but coming back from Iraq, and which anyone who served there has a sort of sense of the burden, just anxiety of how we got into Iraq, and certainly anyone who's been there thinks about it a lot, as I do every day. But to come here and to sit down and talk about Korea and look at what we're trying to do in this alliance, to understand that the ROK is a country that that shares with the United States a common perception, not only in the peninsula, but also in the world. I mean, in Iraq, I think some of my best colleagues were the two Korean ambassadors who were there, one after the other. So it's great to be back talking about a great great alliance and realizing that there's still work to be done. So thank
Chris,
you.
Thank you very much. We do want to reserve some time for Q&A, but let me pose a couple questions here to get the your mind thinking as well. I'm fascinated by the sense that 80% of the American people really would like to see a continuation of the alliance, what was that, 43% with military troops there, 37% continue without, et cetera. And a good deal of this question resolved around the perception of what they would be doing and what the threat they would be faced. And it looked as though it were a containment of China, a concern of China rising. Let's, if I may, just, it's not quite the survey, but let me turn that around and ask our fellow panelists here, how do you think the South Koreans, the South Korean public, would react to the rationale that Americans see the value of the alliance in these terms? And what do you think they see the value of the long term of the alliance in a post-unification environment? Let me just go back, Chris.
Well, first of all, in Marshall's presentation, he had a number of statistics on attitudes to China. And there, too, I think we saw in those attitudes a kind of pragmatism on the part of American people. There was not a kind of sense of doom and gloom or a sense of peril about China. So how the sort of attitudes finally settle out with respect to the troops, I still think it will not be attitudes that will drive us to having these troops either remaining or just the alliance without the troops. I don't think it's about directing that alliance against someone else. I think it really is a reflection of the common interests we have. I mean, I certainly saw that in Iraq. Most of the Korean combat troops had left Iraq, but there were still a number of Korean officers who were there, and some who had actually been integrated into the overall coalition forces. I certainly saw the results of the fact that the Korean troops were up based in Erbil, and the fact that Korea remains, I think, a pretty big player in the Kurdistan area of Iraq. And I think these types of deployments, whatever one thinks of Iraq, but one can imagine other sorts of deployments in the future. I think between these two institutions, that is the U.S. military and the ROK military, I think we'll probably see more of that sort of thing, because we do have a kind of similar view of how of our military institutions within our society. So I think we'll see more of it, and I think it will be a reflection of the intrinsic values of the alliance rather than a common perception of threats.
You know, how would the South Koreans view this? I think there would be, I think there will be, on the one hand, I think there'll be a good deal of support. The notion that Americans feel this strongly of a long-term relationship will be viewed very positively by Koreans. The notion that the purpose of the alliance would then be to balance China is probably something that doesn't make Koreans very comfortable. I think that, and how do Koreans view the long-term relationship with the United States? You know, there's polling, including Chicago Council polling, other past polls of Korean populations have found that when Koreans are asked the question, who is your closest economic partner 10 to 15 years from now, 80% say it's China, right? 80%. But then when they're also asked, who do you see as your primary geostrategic and political partner in the world 10 to 15 years from now, 80% say the United States. Right? So I think for Koreans, it's a more nuanced view. There is certainly a predominant view that the United States remains the key strategic partner into the future, even as China becomes very important in terms of the economic picture for Korea. And I think in some sense that those views have also been enhanced by, you know, all the activity since the sinking of the Cheonan, where I think there are a lot of Koreans that are disappointed with the way China has handled this issue. And I think there will be, this is also a good signal to Koreans that you know, they can help to shape American long, they know that there's a base of American support for a long-term relationship with Korea, and that they can make efforts to try to change how Americans think about that support by working on this soft underbelly to the alliance, by trying to work on a better understanding of the Korean political system, the view of Korea as a free trade nation, these sorts of things. You know, will then lead to the free trade agreement and other things that will dramatically change the complexion, the long-term complexion of the alliance.
Yeah, let me try to add a little bit of texture on the attitudes towards China that we didn't get to talk about, and what may be behind the fact that 43% say that if there's reunification, they want to maintain the alliance with troops in order to counterbalance China. First, just a word about why we pose the question that way. You know, you need to give the right sort of stimulus to in a survey setting to the respondent. You have to give them, usually you have to give them a reason for doing something, right? And otherwise, that distinction between with and without troops is, you know, people draw their own conclusions. It's harder to interpret the results. So we chose that wording. Yes, it's a kind of hard definition of a purpose. But the fact that 43% opted for it, it demonstrates that it had some resonance. Now, the broader picture on American perceptions of China is, as Chris says, fundamentally very pragmatic. They see the rise of China. They clearly recognize that. We ask a question about these following countries, how important are they to the United States? And for the first time in the history of the Chicago Council poll, China, or a country other than the UK or Canada, is at the top of the list. So Americans now consider China the most important country to the United States. There is a desire clearly expressed to work towards friendly cooperation with China, not towards containment. There is not a lot of anxiety. There are some, but not a lot of anxiety about the recognition, and the recognition is clear in the survey, that China's economy will someday be as large or larger than that of the United States, and the Chinese power may sometimes surpass that of the United States, someday surpass that of the United States. At the same time, there is also clear evidence of what in a policy jargon we would call hedging. So if you ask Americans about the future and whether they think someday China might be a military threat to the United States, plurality says yes. If you ask them directly, should the United States and Japan work together, as we did 2 years ago, work together to limit the rise of Chinese power, was the term we used then. I can't remember whether it was a majority or plurality, said yes. We have a separate question in this survey asking whether the U.S. and RK should work together to limit the rise of Chinese power. Again, I can't remember whether there's a plurality or a small majority says yes. That we've interpreted as a kind of soft hedging. That means, in turn, that I think what's really going on here is Americans, believe it or not, have a sense of sort of grand strategy. You know, they see Asia's rising, they see that American important power and influence are declining relatively, they're not freaking out about it, but they understand that for the longer term, a kind of stable balance of power in Asia is something that would be good for us. And they would not be able to articulate in a way that all of us would immediately recognize, but that's what I think, and I'll take responsibility for this rather than my colleagues on the team. That's, I think, the way they're seeing this. So in that context, I think the issue would not be we're there to balance China, but we're there to help ensure that there's Asia remains a strong and stable and peaceful place in which all nations that have an interest in the region none of them is dominant to the detriment of others.
Great. Well, thanks. Rather than continue this, I want to make sure that you have an opportunity to express your concerns, ask questions. And so if you'd like, please raise your hand. Wait for a microphone to come to you. We've got two people here, I believe, that are get to you. But before I do that, I want to, for all of your benefit, if you haven't already, just point out the new director of the Korea Desk, Edgar Kagan, is with us, and appreciate your coming. If we get stumped, we're going to turn the mic over to you, and you'll give us all the answers. Okay. First question here. Microphone, please.
Thank you. My name is Brent Choi from the VOA Voice of America. I have two questions to Ambassador Hill. You are the one of the architect of the six-part talks. When six-part talks will be resumed? Also, what will be the precondition to resume the six-part talks?
First of all, let me also say welcome to Edgar Kagan. Edgar, those of you who followed China, Edgar worked was in the political section in China. He headed up the external political section in China. And so during the six-party talks, Edgar would be on our delegation. So he knows the Korea scene very well from the six-party talks. So Edgar, great to have you here. I won't say welcome to hell because it's really not that bad, you know. But look, I'm really not in a position to forecast when the six-party talks will get going again. But I think certainly the policy complexity between Seoul and Washington is maybe less so than it was 5 years ago or whenever I started this. But the complexity of the situation in Pyongyang is more so. And so I think as we go forward, there's, you know, those of you who think you understand what is going on the internal side of issues in Pyongyang, if you're right, you're going to be very right, because I think that's really going to be the key, how things are going internally there. I like to think that, as I've watched the travels of Steve Bosworth and Sung Kim and the discussions that go on with the ROK and others, that there's a lot more consensus today than there was when we started this. So I'm kind of encouraged on our side, but I think in terms of the what's going on in North Korea, that's the real that will be a real key in answering your question.
Yeah, thanks very much. Now, as Ambassador Hill mentioned, those of you who are following this do know that Ambassador Steve Bosworth is in the region. He's in Beijing at the moment, and he's been giving statements along the line, predicting down to the minute when the six-party talks would resume. So all you got to do is look at those. All right, Admiral McVade.
Eric McVade, the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis, and a retired Navy officer. I want to offer a thought on containment. It may be far from the mainstream. There's something to say for being too close to a power as large and with a strategic depth of China. I'm often reminded of people talk about sending aircraft carriers to the Taiwan Strait. That's the last place I'd want my carriers in a conflict. It's just too close. I was confronted by the Chinese on the realignment of forces to Pyeongtaek, and saying that bothered them because it was so close. And I said, yeah, it bothers me because it's so close. If you were the enemy in that case, it's hard to defend under those circumstances. So I just toss out that there is something to say about it not making a lot of sense on the containment issue. And if anybody wants to comment on it, I'd welcome that too.
Thank you. Thank you, Jack, for assembling such an interesting panel. I have a comment and a question. with respect to the question, how would South Koreans view the alliance given the statistics that Victor said, I would simply suggest that Koreans have a keen awareness that they have been the victim of foreign power, surrounding power aggression for centuries, and they see the alliance as a insurance policy. And I think that's all very healthy and very understandable. With respect to the survey, fascinating survey, terrific questions. Kudos for Victor for helping to insert them. I noticed in the handout that Victor provided that the sample was about 4,300 people. Is that right, or can you tell us something about the sample and how we should think about that?
Sure. I think the number that you may have picked up on is, let me start with this. So the survey was carried out on our behalf by an organization called Knowledge Networks. It's been in existence 10, 15 years, and started at Stanford University by a group of academic survey researchers. Uses the internet as the vehicle rather than the phone, but it starts by choosing, they have a universe of about 50,000 households, which they have selected randomly using telephone numbers. And they recruit those households to participate in this group, this universe of 50,000 households that will be available to fill out surveys. And then when they get a request from us to carry out a survey, they choose randomly the number of households that are wanted for the purposes of the survey. And they approach those households and ask them to agree to fill out the survey. Not everyone agrees. Just like a telephone survey, you get a call and you're walking down the street with your cell phone and somebody wants you to respond to a survey and you say, heck no. You know, so the response rates are lower, and 60, 70%. So out of that 4,500, 2,700 people agreed to fill out the survey. And they do so online. If they don't have internet access, which almost all households now do in the United States, an internet device is provided in order to facilitate that, so there's no, there's no barrier in that sense, no technological barrier to this being a randomly selected sample of the American adult American population, and the sample is selected so as to bring all the ethnicity, gender, race, locational, age, partisan ID, so forth, variables. To about where they should be at the national level, either through initial selection or through weighting. So the actual sample size was 2,700 people filled out the questionnaire, give or take a few. We dropped, for the purposes of our analysis, about 100 households, about 100 respondents, because of various problems in the way we saw them to have filled out the survey, skipping whole batteries of questions, getting lazy in the way they dealt with it. It's about 2,600. I think 2,596 is the answer. That's a very, very large sample. You may have seen the New York Times survey out today or yesterday. It's 900 people. So the norm for a nationally representative, statistically reliable survey, plus or minus 3% margin of error, is about 1,000 people. So we had a much larger survey in order to allow us to ask many more questions. For some questions, we split the sample. So part A and part B, and part A got one set of questions, and part B got another set of questions. So at the very smallest, our sample size was 1,300. The margin of error for anybody, for any question that was asked to all 2,600, is plus or minus, I think, 1.8%. It's extremely low margin of error. Margin of error for anybody who asked, any question that was asked to 1,300 was about 2.5%. All well within the norms of the industry. So you can look at these data and see them on a scientific basis, whatever doubts you may have about the science of polling, of survey research, you may still have, but from the standpoint of the norms that are widely accepted in the industry, when you are looking at these data, you are looking at the views of the entire adult American population.
Thank
Thank you. Hawan Lee, South Korea newspaper, Joseon Ilbo. Welcome back to Washington, D.C., Ambassador here. But I please allow me to make a difficult questions to you. It seems that the criticism of you exists in Washington, D.C., especially in the Obama administration. I heard that some of them criticized that you made a lot of concessions to North Korea, and especially in six-party talks, and that led to the kind of failure to the six-party talks. So what's your opinion regarding that? And secondly, today, New York Times.
Welcome.
New York Times
which
published.
Which part of the survey was that in?
The op-ed of the former president, Jimmy Carter, who had been to North Korea very recently. And he argued that North Korea is ready to resume the six-party talks and accept the provision of the September 19th agreement, which you chaired. So what's your opinion regarding the former president Jimmy Carter's op-ed? And what would you like to suggest to the Obama administration regarding the North Korean policy, including six-party talks? Thank you.
Well, first of all, we have really excellent people in the Obama administration working on this issue, so it's not for me to be giving advice. But let me, unless I'm asked by them, not by you. Let me just, though, go back to the issue of too many concessions. I think what we tried to do was we had a situation where they're producing plutonium. We had real concerns about uranium enrichment, but we knew for a fact, we could see it from satellites, that they're producing plutonium. So the first goal was to shut down the reactor. We succeeded. The second goal on that was to disable the reactor, which was a number of technical things that were done, including, but some less technical than others, namely the imploding of the cooling tower, so that it would not be an easy task to restart the reactor. So since we succeeded in doing that, they have not restarted the plutonium reactor. Now, of course, I know that we continue to be concerned about the stock of plutonium that they already produced, and also concerned about any clandestine uranium enrichment program. But what we do know is they're not producing plutonium today. Did we make concessions to do that? Yes, we did make some concessions. Were they too many concessions? Well, this is a function of a negotiation where you want someone to do something for nothing. They won't do it for nothing. Then you propose things that you will do in order to get them to do it, and you finally have an agreement where they do what you want them to do in return for things that you've given them. The concessions we gave, of course, did not depend on the negotiator. These were done, agreed on back in Washington. So you'd have to ask you'd have to ask the president, you'd have to ask the Secretary of State at the time whether the concessions were too many in their opinion, but they weren't ones that I decided on. I had to take instructions on how many concessions. Certainly, when we got into the fall of 2008, and we ran into difficulties in terms of some of the verification things we wanted the North Koreans to do, we could not agree at that point, and that's when the negotiations were stopped, because they wanted more from us than we were prepared to give. So I think, like a lot of things in life, it's a function of it's a bargain, and you're trying to give as little as you can get in order to get them to do as much as you want, and ultimately you have to make a calculation. In my view, it was worth getting the reactor shut down.
Okay.
Hey,
we can do it later.
I did okay in that answer, don't you think? Jimmy Carter. I'm sorry, I haven't read the op-ed yet. Yeah. Sorry.
I don't think it was an actual op-ed. I think he was giving a talk at the Carter Center that was reported on that looks like a somewhat of an op-ed. Okay, Robin White.
Thank you, Robin White. I'm associated with the Foreign Service Institute. I'd like to turn to the other large power in Northeast Asia. The Japanese certainly noted that Korea was called the linchpin of security in the Pacific because they have always been called the cornerstone. So who's bigger and better, being a linchpin or being a cornerstone?
You know, that language was repeated today. Assistant Secretary Kirk Campbell was up on the Hill. He didn't repeat linchpin, but he did repeat the cornerstone. So, you know, maybe at a point in time we can get him in here to refine the relative strength of linchpin and cornerstone. I don't know if you want to take that on.
So maybe some of you have heard me say this, but when President Obama came out of that bilat in Toronto and said linchpin, all the Japanese journalists went to the dictionary to see whether linchpin and we could be used in the plural or if it was just in the singular. Linchpins. There's no denying that right now the best relationship that this administration has in Asia today is with DROK. I mean, there's no denying that. The domestic changes in Japan were probably the biggest strategic surprise for the Obama administration in Asia. Because you'll remember the first thing they did when they came into office, the first foreign leader to come to the Obama White House was Taro Aso. And the first place that Secretary Clinton went on her first trip was to Tokyo. So I think their assumption was pretty much steady state on Japan, and then you had huge domestic change in Japan to the point where Japan has become a variable. Now, does that mean that it's all Korea and it's not Japan anymore? Of course not. You know, historically, U.S. policy has always seen relations between Japan and Korea for Washington as a positive sum game. We can be strong with both at the same time. But there's no denying, though, that the domestic politics in Japan have made it very difficult for the U.S.-Japan relationship not to sustain itself but to move forward. Right? It can sustain itself. This is a long alliance, many decades, so it can sustain itself. The real question is, can it move forward, and it can do things in the world? And right now, it's a little bit stymied because of the domestic political situation.
All the way in the back.
Hi, I have sort of a two-pronged question, one about the poll and then following the question that was just asked. You know, the discourse in the last, 5 to 10 years has been that what was mentioned on the panel, that when looking at the ROK-US relationship, it needs to stand for something and not just against something. And looking at these polls, we see that 80% want to maintain the alliance, you know, post-reunification, which, you know, that looks promising, but then when you look at the other numbers, it kind of shows that 43% of those people want to counterbalance China. So this shows, again, that they're standing against something and not for something. And it seems to be the problem here is, like, U.S. perception and U.S. knowledge of South Korea. It's not very, I guess they don't have a very detailed, you know, we don't have very detailed knowledge of what's going on in the ROK. So my first question is, if you could educate the general public here, and you could sort of turn the tide of, you know, U.S. perception of Korea and U.S. knowledge of Korea, what would you hope to get out of that? What issues would you hope that the American public would latch onto in our alliance with the ROK, showing that together we stand for something? So what global issues? And secondly, to follow up on the previous question, you know, relatively speaking or comparatively speaking, you could say that just as Dr. Chow was saying, that the relationship with Japan has declined in contrast to the relationship with the ROK. So is there still hope for regional trilateral cooperation? Are there any agreements or are there any situations or promising ideas where if we return the tide on American opinion to stand up for something with ROK, could we rope in Japan on these sorts of issues?
I think what can be done to enhance American basic knowledge about Korea and on what issues? You know, clearly the issues are, you know, fellow liberal democracy in Asia, generally open economic system, a fair trade and free trade nation, you know, all these sorts of issues. It's probably the country the United States has most similar to it in all of Asia. But, you know, Asia's far away. It is far away, and And regardless of how experts may see it, it's not sort of in the everyday consciousness of Americans. I mean, think about the last time Korea was really in the mind of Americans sort of at their breakfast table. It was probably the 1988 Olympics, right? And the 1988 Olympics was 1 year after democratization. So, you know, it hasn't seeped, you know, maybe the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang will do it. Maybe that will help to bring more of this, what we know of Korea today, into the minds of Americans. On the question of trilateral cooperation, I mean, I really defer to my senior colleagues on the panel here who served in the U.S. government because, I mean, Tom Hubbard, Jack, and Chris all tried very hard. I mean, you know, with any policy initiative, always tried very hard to work Washington, Seoul, Tokyo before we took anything to the region.
I would just echo that last point. You may recall a number of years ago the creation of the TCOG, the Trilateral Coordination and Oversight Group. That morphed into something a little bit more informal for a while, but lately the concept is coming back. And so I think that there's a lot of room left for trilateral cooperation involving the United States, Korea, and Japan. So I'm very hopeful in that regard. I don't know, would anybody else like to? No? Okay, well.
I would just make note that just one data point in the survey. We've been asking for some years which country is more important to the United States, China or Japan. And in this survey, for the first time, China surpassed Japan. And if you look at the influence scores on Japan, so forth and so on. So there's something happening in American perceptions of Japan, not an antipathy, but a perception of less influence, less importance to U.S. interests over the longer term.
Let me just add, too, that I agree with Jack that the trilateral cooperation is beginning to come back, and I might contrast the current era with what we saw some 5 years ago when there were a lot of disagreements between ROK and Japan that were right at the surface and made some of this trilateral cooperation problematic. I can remember being in these trilateral meetings, and I ended up in a sort of mediating role at times, which was not the purpose of the trilateral process. So I think the situation is much better today, and I think it holds some promise for the future. You know, it's true Japan has some internal issues today, but, you know, frankly speaking, all three countries have had internal issues at various times, so I don't think we should consider those to be real showstoppers. And with respect to Marshall's point about China and Japan, I would encourage the Japanese not to think in terms of the U.S. relationship with them as somehow being defined with how we're doing with China. I think we have a relationship with Japan that can stand on its own, and I don't think it should depend on how the relationship with China is going. I think more of China doesn't mean less of Japan, and I think when people kind of understand that, I think we'll all be better off.
Thank you very much. Tom, I'll give you the last word.
I suppose I'm revealing my age by saying I actually was interpreting for Ronald Reagan the first time he used the word linchpin for the relationship between the U.S. and Japan. And I didn't know the word in Japanese, but I will never forget it now. It's kaname. And I can't I'm afraid I don't know the word in Korean. But I think it's worth you know, ending on a note that you know, that in many ways we've talked about the advent of the DPJ in Japan as being a source of uncertainty and problems and difficult to but one of the positive benefits, I think, has been a closer relationship between Japan and Korea. They do seem to be working at that, both in the the earlier administration and now with the Khan government. I think better relationship with Korea is a higher priority for Japan and vice versa, and that's good for us.
Good. Thank you very much. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're now running out of time, but let me go back to one of the elements of the survey that I found very, very useful, particularly with regard to the course FTA and, in general, American perceptions about Korea, where it is not so much of getting out there and selling the specific benefits of the FTA, but it is getting out there and talking about Korea in general and raising the educational level, if you will, of the general understanding about Korea, and that, in turn, will lead to a more positive perception of the value of the course FTA. So for that one bit of insight, among many others, I'm very appreciative and thankful. And along with that line, let me just express the appreciation of all of us for the work that the Chicago Council has done on a regular basis, and most specifically what you have done in focusing on U.S. attitudes towards the Republic of Korea. Likewise, the CSIS and Victor Cha, your staff has been instrumental in putting this all together. We at KEI have been the beneficiary. Our staff obviously has worked hard putting up pictures last night and doing lots of other things to make the environment as receptive as possible. And again, I want to express the panel's appreciation and my personal appreciation for Ambassador Hill coming and giving his insights. They're always well worth listening to. So with that, let me, one final caveat. I know that the reporters and you want to mob Ambassador Hill, but I'm not going to let you. He has another obligation immediately following this through the back doors for which you are prohibited from going. I have sharpshooters on the refrigerator prepared to... Never mind. But anyway, thank you very much for your participation.
For more information, please visit our website at www.keia.org.